to Procrastination Planet, where we should be writing, but we're back, everybody. I'm Carly Knight.
And I'm Jill White.
And welcome back to Procrastination Planet. This week, we are going to do part two of the shitty first draft. And that would be flushing that motherfucker out.
I hate the first draft.
Oh, God, I know. It's terrible. So let's get a little housekeeping out of the way. If you like Procrastination Planet, don't forget to like, subscribe, download, whatever it is your platform lets you do. Leave a 5-star rating and a short review if you're on Apple or Stitcher. If you can do something similar on your other podcatcher or whatever podcatcher you listen to this podcast on. Yes, I ended a sentence in a preposition.
It's allowed.
Yes. Anyway, do whatever it is you gotta do to rate, review, help to push us up the charts, get us all famous and shit. Don't forget to go to procrastinationplanet.com and go to the merch page for nifty logo merch. I'm putting the Patreon on sleep for a little bit because I gotta work on those rewards and I have to figure out rewards that aren't gonna take up too much of my bandwidth because I have so much shit on my plate. But also, I want to give people nifty stuff if they donate and I don't want to demand they donate for, like, nothing. I mean, if you do feel called to donate, do it anyway and I'll love you forever. You can also send us some email at procrastinationplanetpod@gmail.com. Don't send any hate mail unless you want me to put you on blast, because we're going to do that, and we'll name names. Okay, that's housekeeping.
On with the show.
So last week, we talked about getting that shitty first draft down.
And the agony it caused us, the suffering, the pain.
Oh, yes. The pressure of writing a great first draft. Your first draft is probably not going to be that great. And if it is, well, I hate you. Not that I'm jealous at all. Nope, not at all. Nope.
No.
Never.
I don't believe anybody writes a great first draft. I mean, everything always needs to be improved.
Yeah. Some people revise as they write. Like, I've seen people with really polished early drafts, but that's not because they slam typed it all out in like some NaNoWriMo fervor.
Mm-hmm.
They revised it as they went along. So they're constantly tinkering and working with it, and it's not like a rough draft.
Right. I guess I can't see me doing that. I would never get all my ideas down if I did something like that. If I went back and corrected everything, I'd never get to the end.
Yeah.
But good on them if they can do that. Mm-hmm.
Some people do it because it saves them from having to do so many rewrites. So if they're doing all that work up front, then it saves them time in the long run.
Okay.
So everyone kind of has their methods.
What is your method?
Okay, so Sabrina and I did an episode on revision, just kind of revision in general. So you might remember some of these points that we bring up from that particular episode. And we're also going to bring in some new insights because I have a new guest on here.
Me.
The illustrious Jill White. So it's always cool to have other perspectives. But anyway, I did want to focus a lot on fleshing out the first draft.
Okay.
So kind of my process, I just try and get it all down as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, when they write a first draft, they write like really bloated, get your ideas all out there and throw everything but the kitchen sink in there. And we kind of have this sort of notion in the writer community that that's what your first draft is. And that revising means just taking out the stuff you don't need. Because I bump into a lot of columns and articles and whatever, and they're like, oh yeah, revising is just take and cut, and not always. Nope.
I see that kind of revising with people writing articles.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they need to be, you know, cut down and revised and reworked.
Yeah. And you have to cut it down to meet that word count.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's funny. For me, I just get my ideas down. So in my case, I need to expand.
And that's kind of my thing too. I tend to write really skeletal first drafts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really jealous of the people who can write the really super bloated, everything but the kitchen sink kind of first draft, because all you have to do is cut. And that is so easy. Like when I'm editing anything, I just cut that extra shit out, boom, and keep it moving. On the other hand, when you have to add things in there, it kind of feels like work. Like I said, I have a tendency to write like a really skeletal first draft. It's just kind of get everything down and then build it up from there.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what I do. I find I need to expand in places. I need to put someone's thought processes in there.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm doing something, it's like I have to tell myself, okay, what is she thinking? you know, well, what's going on in her mind? And I don't do that at the beginning. You know, I just want to get the sort of basic plot or scene in.
Yeah, get the story down right. And maybe a little bit of a character arc if you kind of figured that out. But I noticed, Jill, that like when you critique some of my stuff, mm-hmm. you're really good at spotting where I need to expand on things. Like I found that like in a lot of your comments, you'll put in where I should add in some more description, or maybe one character didn't react to something another character did or a particular situation, and you point that out, and I'm like, duh, of course, I need that. Thank you.
Well, that's where it's good to, you know, bring in other people, because when you're reading someone's work, questions come to mind, right? It's
yeah.
like, you know, okay, this and this happened, and you're looking at it like, okay, where exactly were they? Or, you know, what was it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Did something get in the way? You know, was the other one scared, or were they worried? It's just sort of a natural progression, I think.
Yeah. What would be a physical reaction? What would be an emotional reaction?
Right.
Or, like you said, what is this person thinking as far as a particular situation goes? Or if like your character is going into the dark and scary basement, why are they just going into the dark and scary basement and turning on a light and calling it done? Why aren't they scared? Why aren't they excited? Why aren't they whatever emotion you need, fill in the blank?
Right. Can they see the stairs? Do they feel their way down? That sort of thing.
Yeah. Is it a damp basement that smells like mildew and it's like never been aired out in forever?
Exactly. Yeah.
Is it a well-kept finished basement? And maybe that's scarier because daylight suburban horror, oh my God, in the perfect finished rumpus room with the carpet and the nice ventilation. And I feel like worse things can happen in that one, where the scary basement, you know, or you expect something terrible.
Yeah, that's true.
But in the nicely set basement, you don't expect things to be terrible. And so, boom.
A little twist in your plot.
Yeah.
Well, I find, like in your case, you bring up things. I think sometimes I take the easy way out and I see this. This is a little cliche, Jill. And I think, yeah, I knew you were going to call me on that one. Because it was an easy line to put in, you know. And I think you're good at that. And also at questioning the like where the story's going, you know, which is what I need.
I sometimes tend to lean on cliches too when I'm just like zipping through the first draft, because I just need to get through it. And if I spend so much time trying to think of the cleverer line, I might forget where else I need to go. So sometimes you just have to put in that shitty, cliched, tried ass line and then keep it moving. And then go back and be like, make that shit more clever.
It's very easy to get stuck on a couple of lines.
Oh, yeah.
You can spend hours on two lines. Sometimes it drives me nuts and I realize, oh my gosh, I got like three more pages to deal with.
Yeah.
You know?
I have a scene. I have to go back into chapter 3 and I'm going to submit this for the group. Because I realize, well, my character's best friend is a mortician. And also I realize that she's not on stage very much. Like, I had her coming over to the apartment in Chapter 2, but their dialogue was just kind of meh. Their interaction was just kind of meh. And I feel like I need her to be on stage more. And also, since my main character is kind of an unlikable character, like, she's not real sweet and soft and that kind of thing.
Just kind of hardened and, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, part of it. Digression is like in a lot of TV shows and books and whatever, you get like the white, usually white male brooding anti-hero. He's like, you know, like Walter White or what's his name, the Sopranos,
Tony
Soprano,
mafia Don, guy on Valium or something.
Yeah. Don Draper, you know, you get like the main character, the protagonist, who's just like this anti-hero and sometimes just wild asshole. But it's okay because he's tortured and brooding. And but you get a female character who's every bit as asshole-ish, and that's not acceptable. So I decided to take my female character and make her an asshole.
Good for you.
But I still do want to kind of show that she's...
There's reasons for that, right?
Yeah, there's reasons for that. And also, even with like the brooding anti-hero and whatever, they do have some of their personal interactions where... They kind of show some promise of being a halfway decent human being.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Walter White was sticking up for his son who has cerebral palsy.
Right.
I forgot what he did. Some kid was making fun of him, and so...
I remember that, and he told off that kid.
Yeah.
And, of course, he's dying of cancer, and they can't afford the treatment, and that's...
Yeah. And then Don Draper, he's got his interactions with people who don't fit in. Like, Peggy Olson is kind of... this proto-feminist sort of Helen Gurley Brown type, and he sides with her a lot of the time.
Because he hangs out a bit with the some of the offbeat people, right? The Bohemians or...
Yeah. And so I kind of wanted to show some interaction with my main character and her friend. Mm-hmm. But I have to figure out a scene that's going to move the story forward, too. I had a scene where her friend was kind of helping her get ready for her date that she was going on after being out of the game for a while. But then it didn't move the story forward, and it didn't really... It didn't help the character arc or character development or whatever. It just felt like some kind of chick lit retread.
But write it down, because something might occur, right?
Yeah, I wrote it down and I figure it's not working for this chapter. Cut it out and put it in my little story orphans folder.
Right.
And that way I can use it for later.
Or we might find a way to, fit it in. Yeah.
So I have to work in a scene where... I'm going to work that in chapter 3. I don't want to go spoiling my book for people who haven't read it yet.
So far, it's very intriguing.
Thank you. So I had to show some kind of character interaction. So that's another way of fleshing out a skeletal first draft.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it occurs to you that you need to include another scene.
Right.
Like maybe you don't have a character that's on stage as much as they should be. I think I might have a whole triad going on because I keep referring to my character's cousin, who actually needs a name now because I keep referring to her. And so she's got to be on stage at some point.
You got your triad. Okay.
I'll have my triad.
Yeah. That's sort of what happened to me. I actually got pretty far in writing my story. And I just realized it wasn't compelling enough. There had to be a reason why my characters did what they did with, you know, their device. And
yeah.
So, yeah. And then it became kind of a slog. It's hard to go back, for me anyway, even though I thought of a few ideas and started putting it down, and I actually really slowed down. Now I feel like I'm kind of gaining ground and, you know, the wheels are starting to move and I'm chugging along and I'm getting speed. Yeah.
So if you feel compelled to keep the story going,
right,
a compelling reason to, I don't know, put your character on a quest.
Yes, exactly.
Then you get motivated.
And it all comes about just... you just got to keep writing.
Always write.
Yeah.
Always be writing. But yeah, sometimes when you just write through your draft, it can be difficult. Like we've said before, it can be a slog just to try and write things down. But then when you get to the end of that first draft, a lot of times that's when you realize you need to add things in.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, oh, I need a scene for this. I need to add in a character who does that. I need some world building. Like if you're writing historical or science fiction or fantasy, those three genres require a lot of world building.
Yeah.
So you kind of want to go through and find your opportunities for that.
And that can be a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes that's part of the fun when you go you get to kind of do your scenery porn, as it were.
Yeah, create your own little world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're the all-powerful.
You're the interior designer.
Yes.
So I think we touched on a little bit, a few ways to flesh out a first draft.
Mm-hmm.
You can always go back and look at places where you can add more description. And you can always add that description to the action that makes it move forward a little quicker. If you have like big blocks of static description, it can be a little...
It's a bit boring, actually.
Yeah, you can get your reader to skim it. But if you're making that description...
Work with you.
Yeah.
I remember you pointed that out. I did have one very static chapter and it just... clicked when he said that, because I had these three characters. I really got dinged for that particular chapter too, you know. People were, who said what? Who? You know, there were like these three women there, you know, and I had a lot of scenery there. Make it work with the characters. I said, oh, okay, you know.
Yeah, instead of saying, oh, the couch was velvet, the carpet was green, the wallpaper was purple.
That's a very bright room.
Yes, it's a very colorful room. Hey, I have an orange couch, so.
But it works.
Yes. But anyway, you can have your character take a seat on the orange couch.
There you go. Right.
You can tiptoe across the green carpet.
Move those embroidered cushions out of the way.
Yeah. And how is your character going to move the embroidered cushions out of the way? Is your character reverent of this particular room because they're over for a visit? Do they carefully pick up the cushion and set it aside? Or is this character the type to just pick up the cushion and toss it wherever?
And it was your grandmother's cushion that she spent 2 years embroidering.
Or was it your mother-in-law who always wants you to add a bunch of fussy shit to the house every time she comes over, and then she throws a fit that you didn't add that to the decor, even though it doesn't go with the house?
And you're more than happy to see it tossed against the wall or whatever, yeah.
Fuck this cushion. Not literally.
Hey, you can give a cushion a whole personality right there.
Yeah. And on this rewrite, too, when you're fleshing out the first draft, I would say go a little overboard if you want. Don't feel pressure to have everything perfect, because, again, when you're rewriting, you're going to have a few drafts that you go through regardless. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to go overboard and then cut.
I do that a lot. I mean, even when I flesh out the very first draft, let's say my second draft, mm-hmm. I'm still in my agony stage, you know, adding the meat, filling it out. And I do. I put in everything I think of.
Yeah.
And then I know when I go back, that's where I have the fun of sort of cutting and fine tuning and whatever.
And giving that description some movement.
Exactly.
And another way to flesh out a draft, too, is you have to remember your characters didn't just pop up and exist when the story started. They were born at some point. They had a childhood.
That's right.
They have a past. I mean, you don't want to, like, tell their whole entire life story beginning at chapter one, because that kind of shit is boring. If your reader wanted to read it, they'd read a biography. But you want to figure out places where backstory would matter. Like, maybe they stumble upon, I don't know, a particular locket. They find a locket in the middle of the park or something. Maybe that locket looks familiar. Maybe that locket was something your main character gave to his sweetheart. What is this locket doing not on your sweetheart's neck?
Keep going. I'm really intrigued. I want to hear this.
Did she get kidnapped and the locket fell off somehow? Was the locket stolen and the thief dropped it as he was running off? Was she just like pissed off at him and was just like, fuck this locket, and tosses it off and just lets it land wherever? Did the sweetheart's little sister steal the locket because she thought, oh, it's so pretty and I want to play with it, and then she loses it?
So many possibilities.
Yeah, you can go into a little bit of backstory where, oh yeah, he gave her the locket. Maybe it's like a really pivotal moment because this is when the relationship got serious. Like, it's high school and he didn't want to do a promise ring because that would be weird. He didn't want to freak her out, but he's like, hey, we're going steady, to use that 1950s terminology.
And 60s.
Yeah. So it's like a pivotal moment. So you have a little flashback with that.
Where did he get the locket?
Yeah, maybe the locket's from his mother and that would raise the stakes and he needs to figure out what happened to the locket. He's maybe got to confront his sweetheart as to why she's treating this particular heirloom with such, like, disregard.
And he could jump to conclusions when he shouldn't.
Exactly. Or maybe he got this locket because it's going to be boring if he just goes to the mall jewelry store and gets the locket. Boring. Don't do it. Or maybe he gets this locket. It fell off a truck. So we know he's the kind of guy who's going to get stolen merchandise.
And maybe it's a very special locket that belonged to a gangster's girlfriend or something.
Ooh!
Or the gangster's mother, or who knows? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, there are ways you can bring in someone's backstory.
Now you have to write the story, Carly.
Now I have to write the story. Something about the locket.
That's right. I like that.
Or you have like another scene where, because you want to make sure the backstory is important to the story that's moving forward.
Right.
Because every time you go into a flashback or you reveal a bit of the past and the history, you're stopping the forward action to do it. So you want to make sure you have a really compelling reason to stop the main story.
Right.
Are we going to raise the stakes? Like, let's say your character has to, maybe your character has to deliver a particular package. We don't know what this package is. Let's pretend it's like the suitcase in Pulp Fiction or something. It's important. We don't know why, but okay, it's important. Maybe we flash back to a time where your main character had to make a delivery, but he failed. And he failed with some really horrible consequences. Like, maybe the package he had to deliver, it wasn't really a package at all. It was a cooler with a liver that needed to be needed to be transplanted or something. It was a black market liver that he got to the black market doctor, but so many things were thwarting the mission. You could tell I'm just thinking, I'm just pulling this out of my ass.
These movies I'm coming to mind with these organs that I've watched.
So he's got the bootleg black market liver.
The great race.
Something thwarts the mission. And the guy who needed the liver, because, you know, it's a black market liver,
right,
back alley doctor. He's like this criminal boss who needs the liver, right? And so
Messenger has no idea, right?
Messenger maybe has no idea. Maybe he does have an idea. Who knows?
Maybe there's a higher bidder out there that wants it.
There was a higher bidder. Maybe someone intercepts the liver. And then the other guy, he died. And so now, you know, so now he's, I don't know. The guy's like, okay, well, you killed my boss, or you killed my dad, who is this big boss. Okay, you have another mission you're going to have to go on. And don't fuck this mission up, because it's going to be your liver that's being transplanted next. So, you know. So we have these stakes. So he's got to deliver another liver so that his liver can stay intact.
But he drinks too much. It's not in very good shape anyway.
But he's not going to get a replacement liver. So this is a case where backstory would raise the stakes. He failed one mission before, and he has to complete a similar mission. Otherwise,
he's a goner.
That's right.
You know, be swimming with the fishies.
Luca Brasi swims with the fishes.
So I was thinking, like, other ways of, like, fleshing out your first draft.
I find I have to leave it for a day or so. You know, I get the ideas out. I feel like, I'm exhausted. You know, the brain's worked, overworked in my case. So I walk away from it and get refreshed, being on the computer, hitting that refresh key. And that's what refreshes me, is walking away.
Oh, yeah.
You know, doing something else, very different, something maybe physical, walking or get going outside, getting some fresh air, you know.
Physical exercise is good for your mental exercise as well.
Yes. And then I'm ready to go back and attack it again.
Yeah. And I think one of the challenges, too, is you want to flesh out the first draft because you don't want it to be a novella. Maybe your goal is to write an actual full-length novel, and you don't want to write a short story, or it's too long to be a short story, not long enough to be a novel. But the idea you have is, like, too big for a short story. So you're like, oh, God, I do have to add more things in. But you don't want to do padding, because people can feel it, like, when you're just adding stuff for the sake of adding, you know, like the bloated description that does nothing.
Right.
Adding in your character's life story when no one gives a fuck at this particular moment. I don't need to know the exact dress you wore at the recital your mom forgot to go to. If your mom forgetting to go to the recital doesn't have anything to do with your character's sense of abandonment or betrayal or whatever.
Right. It sounds like in the old days when they were paid by the word, when they wrote.
Mm-hmm. So you don't want to do that. So that's why you do kind of have to be careful with your description and your backstory so that you're not just, you know, padding. Like Elmore Leonard said, leave out the stuff that your reader tends to skip. That's how the quote goes, right?
Something like that, yeah.
But you can also do, like, get into the emotional interior of your character. Because sometimes you have your character just acting and doing, and your action scenes read more like a report.
And that can be boring, too. It's, you know, it's like he goes from A to B to C to D, and that's it.
How does he feel? Yeah. What are his emotions? Is he up against an opponent who is a lot more formidable?
Mm-hmm.
Formidable. What? I don't know. Okay.
I knew what you meant.
Anyway.
And what's happening around him that's making him, you know, maybe the environment is making him react that way, too, right?
Yeah.
You know, is it raining? Is he, you know, running for cover and he has to find the right cover so nobody else will find him?
Is the rain gonna, I don't know, affect his vision when he's trying to fight the big bad?
Right.
Is the rain pelting him right in the eyes? And so it's kind of hard
see.
To.
Right. And maybe he runs for cover and ends up under the wrong cover, you know.
And there's a rabid raccoon.
The mean streak a mile wide, yeah.
Or is he scared of the raccoon? Or is he like, oh, I can wind up this raccoon, piss it off, and throw it at the big guy.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. The raccoon would be like, bitch, please.
So, yeah, I mean, you can kind of turn a scene into something really compelling.
Yeah. Show who your character is in the heat of the moment. Like, is your character a knee-jerk, reactive kind of person? Like, are they just going to react to something and then think later and go, oh, shit, I shouldn't have done that. Or are they the kind of person that plots and plans and is like really super careful?
Mm-hmm. And frustrates other people because that character does take his or her time?
Yeah. So look for opportunities to show how your character feels in a particular situation. I mean, you don't have to do like a mushy little diary entry with every single step they take. Because sometimes you do have to just get your character from point A to point B. There was a chapter in a book I was reading. It was a how-to book, and it was called Getting There Isn't Half the Fun, It's Boring. You had to get from point A to point B because, you know, your road trip, your bus ride, your car drive, that's usually just boring shit. And you're reading it as a reader, and you're like, okay, can we get to the scene where the things happen already?
Mm-hmm.
But if there's something at stake during the ride, like in The Accidental Tourist, that car ride in the beginning, it's super fraught with tension. And that's a case where driving from point A to point B really works.
Right. Kind of sets the story up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what, you know, going from one point to another can also be a chance for your character to be thinking, you know, wondering, you know, what am I doing? You know, why am I involved? Or what, you know, whatever's going on through the character's mind.
Yeah, maybe there's this impending sense of dread they have,
right,
but they have a history of panic attacks and anxiety, and they think, okay, maybe I'm just having, okay, maybe I'm just having an anxiety attack. Okay, what did my therapist tell me to do in this particular moment? Okay, I'm going to do this. But then it turns out that they had reason for a panic attack because there was a murderer in the back seat, and it was something that she recalls as she's having to fight this guy off. Oh, yeah, I recall seeing a little flash in the rearview mirror, or there was, I don't know, a lump in the messy pile of blankets that I meant to clear out and put in the laundry that didn't belong in there. Or so clean out your car so murderers don't hide in the mess.
There you go.
FYI. Cautionary. I think another way of fleshing out the draft, well, basically when you're fleshing out a first draft, like the backstory, the emotion, descriptions, it adheres to that adage of show, don't tell that you're always hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Show, don't tell. What does show, don't tell mean? Well, give us descriptions. Give us the five senses. And that's what you could do with your descriptions as well. You don't have to just have a bunch of, like, describing what the room looks like. Maybe describe the smell of something. Maybe the smell is something that tips your character off that something is going wrong.
Right.
Like, maybe your character smells a particular cologne. And they're like, oh, wait, who's here?
That cologne maybe takes that character back to it.
Yes, and smells are very big triggers for backstory. Boom. You can work those two things in.
Right. And so is music, certain melodies. I was just thinking, you know, so many times in a book, I see the word amazed. He was amazed. She was amazed.
Show me how amazed they are. Does their jaw drop in awe? Do their eyes bug out? Does their heart race?
Do they drop their pen?
Mm-hmm. The emotion thesaurus is a really good resource for showing how your character is feeling. That way you can go beyond just plain, he was amazed, so his jaw dropped. It kind of gives you suggestions for kind of how to put some stank on it, as it were.
Mm.
He was angry. His eyebrows scrunched down. That's not really doing anything. Do something with that. Be like,
he threw a book at her.
He threw a book at her. His eyebrows scrunched together and this furrow carved itself in the middle of his brows. And any deeper, he would need a bone graft or something.
That was pretty descriptive.
His anger was carving a big furrow between his brows. He could almost feel a bunch of pickaxes.
I was going to say he went bright red.
It was as if the gods themselves took a pickaxe to the middle of his forehead.
There you go. Oh my gosh.
You got to do something with the physical reactions.
That's very creative.
Like, maybe your character has a mission because they have to deliver that liver so that they can keep their own intact. But there's a subplot going on. Like, maybe his girlfriend with the locket, I don't know, she comes to play in there somehow. So you got the romantic subplot, or maybe it's not a romantic subplot, but it's the subplot with his girlfriend.
Right.
And a lot of times your subplot should kind of play into the main plot a little bit. Like, maybe it turns out that, I don't know.
I'm thinking of The Accidental Tourist.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to that.
Yeah, let's do that.
So, the subplot where I think the main character's dog attacks people.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes it to this woman who's a dog trainer. And, of course, this dog comes into play again when the main character's think is that his publisher comes to visit him and the dog chases him up a tree and he meets the main character's sister.
Okay.
And so there's a subplot between them. And they're kind of...
Don't they have to go to the wedding or something?
They're a quirky family. The sister and the publisher get married, but then she comes back home because she feels she's got to look after him and the other brother. Anyway, but the dog, that's where the dog came in as well. You know?
Yeah, and that kind of works into the main plot where... is it Mason or Macon? I forget the main character's name.
Macon, I think. That's been a while.
Because he has to come to terms with grieving his son, but he also has to stop living like this safe sort of existence.
And the woman who helps him with the dog kind of brings him out of that, doesn't she? Yeah. She's very, in her own way, very quirky too.
Yeah. So you've got kind of the romantic subplot, the dog subplot, his main character arc.
Mm-hmm.
So they all kind of wind up together. So, you know, find in some subplots. When in doubt, you can throw in a romantic subplot. Throw in a romantic subplot. Throw in a little side mystery.
Yeah.
That's kind of peripheral. Like maybe the mystery to the locket has to do with, I don't know, maybe the mystery that he unlocks with the locket also helps him, like helps propel him to deliver the liver quicker. I don't know.
We need to flesh this one out here.
Yeah, we got to flesh this one out.
I was thinking maybe he pulls into a side road, finds the locket, and picks it up, not thinking about it. Oh, this is nice. Wonder where this came from.
Yeah.
Another possibility, right?
Maybe the locket belongs to the other person who is like getting the liver. Or maybe the locket has to do with the guy who's got him on the mission in the first place, and he's the antagonist, and maybe the locket has some blackmail information in it.
Yeah.
Like it's a picture of him and the mistress together, and
maybe it's attached to the handle on the liver box.
Yeah, the liver box. Don't mind us. This is a
the
shitty...
cooler. Sorry.
This is a shitty first draft we're working on, okay? Don't mind us at all.
I think we're creating a good story here.
Yes, we are.
Sometimes it's fun.
Yes. The shitty first draft, think of it as manure that helps you grow a good story.
You got to shovel it in.
That's right. You got to shovel on the manure. So, you know, subplots are a good way of adding to a skeletal first draft.
They do. They give depth and layer to your story as well.
They kind of help show your characters what they're made of.
I was thinking your triad, even, you know, the other two. Well, you know, I'm going back to Harry Potter, of course, with Hermione. Am I saying it right? Hermione and Ron and their subplots, right? And it all adds to the story. In the end, it all came together.
Yeah, sometimes those subplots kind of propel the character arc as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe that little side mystery shows a side of your character who normally lives a criminal life, but maybe they find the locket and try and return it to the right person. And it shows that maybe they have a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of honorable characteristics.
Or in the end, they become honorable. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah, maybe he stole it from someone. The girlfriend was drunk one night and he got it off her, knowing that it would piss off her boyfriend.
Yeah.
Well, boy, all kinds of ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, too, there used to be a guy in our group, and every time he would look at a draft, he would be asking where the tension was. And 9 times out of 10, he was right. Kurt Vonnegut once said that your character needs to want something in every scene, even if it's just a glass of water. So when you're going through your scenes, ask yourself if your character is getting what they need a little too easily. Ask yourself what could go wrong and make it go wrong.
Right.
You could add to your word count that way because your character is on a mission to try and get what they want because they're not getting what they want at the moment if you're making things go wrong. Add some tension. Add some obstacles. You can, you know, put in some plot twists. So basically, if you have more tension, you have more difficulty, you're putting your character on a mission and you're making them work harder. And that means more pages and words.
And you're making the story more interesting.
Exactly.
If it's too easy, it's boring.
So that's a way of fleshing it out without padding. Also, too, when you're writing your first draft, your plot isn't always going to be all that great. Maybe you have these twists that come out of nowhere. Or at the end, your character gets rescued by the cavalry, as it were. Your whole Deus Ex Machina thing going on.
That comes from typing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that for me, I find once I start typing, then the ideas start flowing. And I think, oh, that came out of nowhere. And
yeah,
didn't really, but that's because other ideas formed it. But you're not going to get the idea until you bring forth the boring ideas.
So what you can do when you're trying to flesh out that first draft is go back and find opportunities to set up what was that plot twist? And that way, when your reader, well, reads it, they're like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. Or they'll be like, oh my God, I should have seen that coming. Of course. Instead of, where the fuck did this come from?
Yeah. When it comes out of the blue, it doesn't feel right either. You know, there's got to be something in the past to set it up.
Yeah. You want to set it up without telegraphing it.
Exactly.
Because in Devil in a Blue Dress, Easy Rollins kind of gets rescued seemingly out of the blue by Mouse.
Mm-hmm.
He almost gets stabbed by Frank Green, and then Mouse comes in with the gun. But then you go back and you realize, oh yeah, I forgot if he called or if he wrote a letter to Mouse. Because he was the only friend who could kind of help him out of this particular jam. Because he had one friend who was dead and one friend who is... I think he was kind of religious and his morals wouldn't let him do this kind of gray area kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh God, I got to turn to Mouse. And we've had enough flashbacks with Mouse to know that he's like really hair trigger temper and you don't want to cross this dude. But also, he's the kind of guy, if you're on his good side, he's your ride or die motherfucker.
He's super loyal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a damn good friend until you fuck with his money.
Yeah, you reminded me of Chinatown. It was one really good scene where the characters, they're checking out the senior home. They're really trying to get information about the people who are in the home, and they're, you know, these older people are being manipulated. And the people who run it, I think, start getting wise. And so Faye Dunaway goes off to get the car, and Jack Nicholson, who's the detective, is trying to, I think first he's trying to talk to them and then starting to get really violent. And then suddenly more burly men come on the scene and you think, oh my gosh, he's in big trouble. And what's really good, and actually I remember the first time I saw it in the theater, the audience cheered, was that we'd forgotten Faye Dunaway went to get the car.
Yeah.
She comes barreling down the road and she's ready to run these guys over. And of course, Jack Nicholson hops on the, what do you call that? That walk thing on the gangplank or what do you call it? The sideboard.
The running board.
The running board of the car. And she drives off and saves him. But the thing is, he had told her earlier or whatever, she went to get the car. And so it wasn't like, oh, sudden out of the blue, the cavalry came. She was there. And that's what was so good about the scene. It wasn't just random.
Yeah.
But you got so caught up right after that, you forgot about her.
Exactly.
And everybody loved it. I mean, the whole audience, I'll never forget that. They were cheering.
And that's kind of like with Devil in a Blue Dress. There's so much going on and so much turmoil that particular setup was subtle enough that it wasn't telegraphing that.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't telegraphing because there's enough that happened in between point A and point B.
Right.
You're not reading it going, oh yeah, Mouse is going to come in and save the day. You're reading it like, oh my God, Easy's going to get stabbed. Oh shit. Oh, and the chapter ends. Oh, fuck. Oh, Mouse. Oh my God. Yes. Mouse is there. Thank you, Mouse. What about the mouse?
Exactly. And that's what we enjoy, what I enjoy anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these little subtle twists. You know, you didn't see that coming because you got caught up in something else. You know?
So go in your first draft and find the places where your plot twist seems to come out of nowhere. Find your out of the blue moments. Find your deus ex machinas. Find your cavalries. And then go back further and find ways of setting that shit up.
What was that you said? It sounded Latin.
Deus ex machina, the god in the machine.
Oh.
That's like when the gods come in at the last moment and save your hero.
Mm-hmm.
And then, let's see. So we want to set up our plot twists. We want to set up our so-called cavalries. Oh, yeah. So in one of my mysteries I had, I needed more suspects. Because I only had like two suspects, and you need to have like 3 to 5 suspects going on in your mysteries.
Yeah.
You don't want too many because then that gets overwhelming, but you don't want too few because it's a little too predictable. So I added some suspects and they kind of came out of nowhere. So in my second draft, I had to go through and set them up earlier.
Right. You know, it's funny when you said that because it immediately brought to mind the book Jamaica Inn. Did you ever read that?
No.
You know, Daphne du Maurier?
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying her name right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I loved Rebecca.
Yeah, I loved Rebecca. I loved Don't Look Now.
I didn't read that one, but I read My Cousin Rachel.
Have you seen the movie of Don't Look Now?
No.
Oh, my God. Julie Christie, Donald Sutherland.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to see it.
I will.
You're required
to
see it. It's super cool.
But it's funny. I read Jamaica Inn, and then my husband read it. And when we finished it, First of all, he has this extremely annoying logical mind.
I'm married to a physicist.
Okay, so all right. And he, you know, and I was sort of like, well, you know, did you think it was blah, blah? And he just turned to me and he said, there were only like three or four characters in the book. You know, who else could it have been? I mean, there was this guy and this one. And of course, I mean, you know, it was like, he just sort of, you know, I'm going back several years, of course. And he said, of course, who else would have been? And he just ruined it for me. So anyway, not to diss her book, but Rebecca's much better.
Yeah. Don't Look Now is amazing, though.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
I always liked Julie Christie, some of the movies she's been in.
Yeah. I remember watching Dr. Zhivago. God, what was it? I think it was my sophomore year. It was in my world history class. We had a sub that day, and we were supposed to watch Dr. Zhivago. And so the sub picked up where we left off. And no, that's not how it went. No, we started watching the movie with the sub.
For the sub?
Yeah, that's kind of a sub's dream day, too.
Yeah.
And then he had to stop the movie every so often to, you know, talk about some historical plot points and whatever. Mm-hmm. And then he had to stop the movie real quick because of Julie Christie. And he's like, don't you want to go to the prom with her?
I had heard. Do you remember the one point where she was wearing this red dress and she was showing it to the creep who her mother liked, the lawyer, I forget his name. Do you remember that scene?
Barely.
Okay. Apparently, this was an outtake with the director or somebody, and she hated that scene, the actress Julie Christie.
Uh-huh.
And she hated the dress, and he had explained to her, your character, Laura, also hates the dress. Of course she hates the dress, and she hates the man who bought it for her and wants her to model it. It was just so cool the way he explained it to her. Like, yeah. That was the whole idea.
Use that hatred.
Yeah.
Enforced method acting.
There you go. Yeah. Funny, I watched it recently, and I guess times have changed. I guess David Lean likes this beautiful scenery, the scenic mm-hmm. camera things, and I'm thinking, okay, I've seen that. Let's keep going.
Blue pencil, let's get to the scene. Right. What's happening? This is your static description. Come on, make it work with the plot.
Right. I blame it on Sesame Street. You know, every 20 seconds or whatever, they change their their scene. It's ruined me.
Yeah. The costume porn in Dr. Zhivago. Oh, my God. Oh,
I know.
So, yeah, I think those are some really good ways of kind of fleshing out the draft without padding it and boring the hell out of your reader.
Making it part of the story, moving the story on. I know we said it before, but having the critique group really helps because certain people and you think, okay, what's so-and-so going to say about this? What's so-and-so going to say about that? I mean, there's one guy who accused me of trying too hard to use a word from the thesaurus, and I got upset when he wrote that. Then later I figured he was right, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I get butthurt sometimes and I'm like, but in fine, the end, you're right.
You're right, you know, and, and I thought I was being so clever here and two people were saying, no, that's dumb. It wasn't dumb, but you know, it was like, well, I thought I was being clever and I guess maybe I wasn't.
Yeah, I've had moments where I'm trying to be clever, like when, was it one of the chapters? She meets back up with her hiking group and mm-hmm. she's walking under the shade. So I wanted to have some description, you know, so that we're in with the scenery and sensory stuff, blah, blah, blah. Right.
Right.
But then she's walking under the trees, shading me from the sun. And I'm thinking, no shit. That's what trees do. And so I forgot what line I had, but I was trying to find a better way of kind of like bringing that about.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy in the group was like, I don't understand what's going on here. What's this? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I was trying to be clever and it didn't work. We can disregard that.
Yeah,
it didn't work.
Yeah. Sometimes at the time when they point it out, you know, just like that, you realize, yeah, you're right. You know,
yeah, I'm cringing.
Because I know when, you know, I'd used one particular verb and somebody said to me, that doesn't work here. And I realized that, you know what? I didn't like it at the time. I just left it. And
mm-hmm.
they're right. You know, I got to work on that. And then other times it's like, I don't look at my papers right away,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I go the next day when I figure I'm, you know, had a good night's sleep or mm-hmm. whatever, a night's sleep, maybe not good. And then look at it and think, yeah, okay. Yeah, they're right. And sometimes I don't always agree. And I think it's okay to not agree.
Exactly.
And not,
I mean, sometimes you have your placeholder words and then you're like, I don't know what to do here. But then sometimes your group will have some suggestions.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, you don't want your group to dictate your style or anything, because sometimes you write in a particular fashion, like maybe you are a more descriptive writer, or maybe your voice, like your narrative voice is a little more on the quirky side, or maybe your narrative voice is a little more on the no nonsense, Joe Friday side.
Right.
So you're not going to ask your Joe Friday writer to be all florid and opulent with the description or whatever.
That's true. And I sometimes feel the couple who, when they make some of their changes, it's their style they're bringing in.
Yeah.
Which I guess they can't help. But I'm thinking, no, that doesn't work.
Yeah. I try and move out of the habit of like changing certain things. If a sentence doesn't make sense, though, if it's not clear, I'll try and word it in a way that's a little more clear.
Right.
But I don't want to feel like I'm changing somebody's style either.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I'll have to have a note like, in your own words, of course, I'm just trying to make it clear. I'm not trying to change your style. Because there's some fixes that I see where I'm just like, that's not going to work because it doesn't fit the voice or it doesn't fit the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are some fixes where I'm like, oh yeah, that word choice didn't quite work. Or that sentence was a little too bloated or that fragment didn't work. Because I use a lot of sentence fragments and comma splices in this particular voice because that's just how my narrator rolls. But there are times where the fragment or the comma splice is total overkill, so I have to kind of pull back from that.
Well, that's where the group helps too.
Yeah.
Like I said, and keeping certain people in mind, like, okay, word choice, too many adverbs. Could I use a stronger verb? Maybe I need the adverb, you know.
Or I go, wait, do I have my character reacting enough? Do I have enough description?
Do I have too much description?
Yeah. Is this description boring?
Does it work? Yeah. And sometimes you don't have the time. You're trying to get it done because you want to go to the group. You want to read. And
yeah. I want to read, but I don't want to piss off my fellow critiquers because I have something that's unreadable.
Yeah, exactly. So you try and finish it. And then as I read, I think, oops, sorry. Oops, sorry. Oops, forgot that word.
Yeah. Sometimes I will read it out loud at home just to make sure, you know, I don't have like an incoherent mess because I don't want to do that.
That's a very good idea.
Yeah. So I managed to catch like the lion's share of the fuckery. But then when I read out loud in the group, I find new things and I'm like, oh no.
Well, that's just the way it is. It's always going to be something.
I have a tendency to leave words out because it's like, I type.
You think you see them because they're supposed to be there.
And plus my mind is super fast. It's like just this. I don't know. It's like a hyper terrier. Like when Charlie was a little 2-year-old and he would go into his wild puppy tears, like running these quick little figure eights on the carpet, just out of nowhere, just
hamster in a wheel.
Yeah. So my mind is kind of that way. And so I think faster than I can write. And then when I write, I tend to leave words out and I'm like, oh crap. I'm not a total slob, I promise.
I know. I mean, I try to reread my work and stuff. Like, yeah, this will work. And then when you read it out loud,
you're like, whoops. Okay, maybe not. Not so fast.
Yeah.
Not so fast.
Just keep going. Yeah. They'll fix it for me. You guys will fix it for me.
Yeah, fix it for me. Here, fix it for me. But that's kind of the joy of the
there.
Group, though.
Because
sometimes a chapter doesn't work, and I have to keep in mind it's a critique group, not a give me head pats and tell me I'm pretty group. Although if you want to give me head pats and tell me I'm pretty, I'll be happy. So sometimes I'll write a scene or a chapter and I hate it and I'm almost embarrassed to show it to people.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
I want people to be impressed with my writing because I'm a good writer and that's my identity. I base my identity on being a damn good writer and I don't want to like disabuse anyone of that notion.
I love your honesty.
I'm such a narcissist about it. But it's true. I am a damn good writer.
You are.
I
agree with you.
And I want people to constantly tell me that
you're
that
a
I'm a great writer. And
you're
I want my accolades. So if I show them a shitty first draft, they'll be like, oh, she's a fraud. But no.
No.
Your first draft is always going to be a piece of shit, okay?
We like it when you're human, too.
Yes, we are all human. I'm hashtag relatable. Stars, they're just like us. So
Carly's a star.
I am. I'm a star, damn it. I'm a superstar. You know, so then I pull my head out of my ass, right? And I realize, oh, yeah, I'm part of a critique group. We help each other out.
And everybody's happy to help.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm at my wit's end with a chapter. I'm like, tear it the fuck up. I don't care. So last week we talked about writing that shit down. And this time we're talking about fleshing that shit out.
Fleshing it down. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Flesh down the stuff you don't need to.
Right.
Flesh it out. Flesh it down.
And it can take a while. I mean, you know, who was it? Jeffrey Archer when he wrote. You know who Jeffrey Archer is?
Yeah,
he wrote a lot of books, but he was talking about one of his books and he did 14 rewrites on the whole book.
Wow.
Yeah. So it can, I mean, everybody's different, of course, but it can, you know, just it takes time, you know?
Yeah.
Trying to get the right voice, the right words. And it's, it helps to have other people, you know, to read it with you and see if it sounds real to them.
Makes a lot of sense.
And maybe I'll make dollars someday.
But
sorry.
We all love our bad puns here.
We are a punny group. I mean, yeah. That really comes out.
So that was First Draft Fuckery, part two. So my thing about swearing, I swear all the time. I swear all the time in the podcast. But and also like when people like write something on Facebook and they try and censor out the swears. But it's like, I know what you're saying. Why are you putting the asterisk in there? That's stupid. But I do that if I have swearing in a title of a podcast, because I know it makes me sound like a hypocrite. But on the other hand, I think like some platforms, they'll censor you out if you have swearing in there. So I'll have something in there just to get past the censor. So I try not to have titles that are too sweary, unless that's like the only super funny way I can do it.
Too sweary.
Anyway, okay, so thank you for staying tuned for parts one and two of writing and revising the shitty first draft. I'm Carly Knight.
I'm Jill White.
And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Procrastination Planet has been written and produced by me, Carly Knight. Our logo is designed by C. Trojan of C. Trojan Art. Our theme music is Laser Unicorns by Christian Penn, courtesy of Jamendo Licensing. Check us out at procrastinationplanet.com. Over there, you can catch links to our bonus content for every episode, as well as links to our Patreon and our Teespring pages. All other sound at Procrastination Planet is courtesy of Charlie and Holly, our official podcast puppies. Don't forget to drop us an email at procrastinationplanetpod@gmail.com. Let us know how we're doing.